Yesterday, March 14th, was a banner day in the global Mazel and MASH community, the approval of the first indicated drug for MASH in the U.S. For everyone who cares about what happened yesterday, or more broadly has an interest in MASH or steatotic liver disease, surfs up, a very special Season 5, Episode 6 of Surfing the MASH Tsunami, celebrating Resdifra, starts now.
Today on Surfing the MASH Tsunami.
The obvious thought I had driving this morning is I want to use it in my advanced patients first, the ones that are F3, and I want to prevent cirrhosis. And then I sat back and said, you know, I discussed with Ian a lot of times, how can I separate a cirrhotic patient using NITs from the non-cirrhotic patients?
It will give us an opportunity to enhance that message, that message of lifestyle intervention is as important now and probably more important now than before, because you've got something.
This will also be helpful in terms of reducing stigma. Once you're able to add a medication into the recipe of what is coming from your provider on this, then it suddenly kind of medicalizes the behavior and the lifestyle changes that need to happen.
First thing I did yesterday was to dive into some of our local data of patients who've been biopsied who've got FIB4, ELF, and FibroScan to try and look at what the probability of significant or advanced fibrosis that isn't cirrhosis would be present in those patients. And actually, it looks like it's as difficult as I thought.
The specificity is good, but the sensitivity, depending on who's performing ultrasound. If it's an experienced, of course, ultrasonographer, it's okay. But I would even go maybe to CT scan sometimes when you have any doubts.
Folks talk about systems theory and they don't really want to get into any details. They give the example of a butterfly flaps its wings in Tokyo and 3 days later there's a rainstorm in Chicago. This was the butterfly. And my point is that we are frequently way too confident about the linear paths that things are going to take.
FDA's approval of Resdifra on March 14 was historic for the global MOFLD and MASH community. We now have an approved drug for MASH. Today, join hepatology researcher and key opinion leader Jörn Schattenberg, liver health advocate Louise Campbell, pricing and forecasting guru Roger Green, and this week's guests, hepatology researchers and key opinion leaders Zobair Younassi, Lauren Castera, and Ian Rowe, and Global Liver Institute Vice President of Liver Health Programs, Jeff McIntyre, as they share their excitement about Thursday's announcement and consider what it means for stakeholders in the U.S. and worldwide, this week on Surfing the MASH Tsunami.
Remember to stay tuned after this episode for this week's question of the week.
So, as I say, big day yesterday. If you were a day trader, you could have made a fortune yesterday because yesterday morning, AASLD posted on their website that it had been approved. And then Madrigal and AASLD had to take it down. And as soon as that happened, the stock price dropped 5%. Then at the end of the day, 4:17, when the approval was officially announced, it went up 22% after hour trading. So if you knew exactly when to buy, you could have had a heck of a day. I'm not a day trader, and I tend not to invest in my sponsors. So unfortunately, I didn't take part of that. For those of you who did, congratulations. More broadly, congratulations to everybody in the global steatotic liver disease community. A fantastic day and exciting news. And we're going to be talking about that in several different ways as we go along. To join, we have a audience of global stakeholders. I'll start at my lower right and I'll go from there. Our American key opinion leader today is Zobair Younassi. Zobair, how are you doing today?
Thanks, Roger. Glad to be here.
What time did you start this morning?
I think 6 o'clock. My time.
That sounds about right. And then if I move to his left, we have Jörn Schattenberg. Jörn, good evening.
Good evening, Roger. Hi, Zobair and my colleagues.
Hey, everyone.
I'm glad to be here. And indeed, it's been very exciting.
It is exciting. And then to his left, our other permanent co-host, Louise Campbell. Louise, last time I saw you, you were on a GLI thing an hour ago. How are you doing today?
I'm very well. Thank you very much. Nice to be back with such good positive news since we've been here with some negative ones in the past.
Yeah, that's true. We have. And then Ian Rowe. Ian, how are you today?
Yeah, good. Thank you. Hello, everybody.
And then we're hoping to hear from Laurent Castera, although he's on a train, so we're not sure yet exactly how that's going to work. And then finally, we have Jeff McIntyre, our friend from Global Liver Institute. Hey, Jeff, how are you doing this afternoon?
Doing well. I'm on the other side of the river from Dr. Younassi, I believe, and I think we both agree it's a beautiful day here in the Washington, D.C.
It's a beautiful day here as well, weather-wise, metaphorically, however you want to think about it. So without more said, I mean, what makes this day special is obvious, which is yesterday was different. Became the first drug to get approved by FDA for treatment of patients with F2 and F3 fibrosis. We'll get into the labeling as we go along, but the labeling was probably about as good as anybody could have expected. And enthusiasm has been pouring out from all different kinds of sources. Although I didn't see anybody shooting off fireworks last night physically. visibly. But past that, you kind of get to everything. So let's just do simple groundbreakers, okay? Other than Rezdiffra, which we'll come back to in a minute, one piece of good news, personal or professional, in the last week. Brave one, go first.
My son has decided that he worked for Sierra Vermont and decided that he is going to become a commercial pilot. So he got his license the past week, his private license to fly. So he's going to fly us in the near future with a plane. That's a good news for me.
That's great. Congratulations.
Congratulations.
I have a couple of friends who are pilots. They've got great lives. Of course, they have to work, but they get to spend a day or 2 days everywhere they ever go. It's pretty cool.
Especially if you fly to Paris or to Spain or to Italy or to beautiful Germany or Denmark or England. I mean, that's great to do this.
All right. I don't know that anyone's going to top that one on that level, but brave one, go next.
I'm not sure about it. Topping is not possible. Professional, it's been busy. I was in a meeting yesterday in Amsterdam, saw Laurent there. So I know he's still on his way back from that meeting. Personally, I'm looking forward to a week of skiing. The week after next, there's a short break for us and we're hitting the mountains. So that's a lot of excitement personally.
Fantastic. Next.
I'll jump in next. I've just enjoyed a beautiful weekend skiing up in Andermatt in Switzerland. So it was lovely. Good fun.
Superb. Next.
Yeah, we've had a good, exciting week in Leeds. We've had two grants, one recommended for funding and one through the initial triage stage. And I don't think I've ever had two grants through in a single week. So that makes this perhaps the most exciting week of my career so far.
Yeah, that's not bad for a month, hey? It's great when you can collapse time like that. Fantastic, Jeff.
So I kind of held off until last to provide a transition point. And as much as I want to follow Louise's lead and talk about the winning at Liverpool or, you know, the things that we usually celebrate here, I want to call out something that's very liver related that I think has gotten overshadowed in the midst of the NASH stuff, which is that the FDA actually approved two liver drugs this week. There's resmetirom, which we're familiar with, but they also approved Livmarli, I think I'm providing that correct, which is a repurposed medication. It was previously approved to treat cholestatic pruritus in patients with Alagille syndrome, but now this week's approval, actually, it's now available for patients with two of three rare pediatric liver diseases that causes pruritus. And so if you've got PFIC, if you've got Alagille, PBC, and cholestatic pruritus, holy cow, guys, we got two across the line in 1 week. I'm just thrilled. All the energy is on NASH, but dude, we got two across the line. We're so thrilled and happy about that and about happy for liver patients that can be served.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I saw the Livmarli announcement and said, that's really excellent. That's an exciting thing. You know what? I don't have anything to top what's just happened. I was going to talk about soccer, but we'll skip the fact that Tottenham just did the kind of thing Tottenham never does and just ripped the heart out of Aston Villa last weekend, which promises well for us getting into the Champions League that. And how this week's results, which meant that England gets 5 places. If England gets 5 places, I'm pretty certain we'll be there, which means that you can listen to Louise and me talk about Champions League football all year next year as we tease Ian, who won't be there, and Jorn, who's just hoping that Mainz will stay in the Bundesliga. All right. With that, obviously, the most exciting thing that's happened this week for those of us in this part of the world is finally getting a drug over the line for the treatment of MASH, right? I remember at one point, the first time that obeticholic acid went down, somebody ran a headline in one of the business publications and said, MASH 9, pharmaceutical 0, or MASH 11, pharmaceutical 0. I forget the number, but I remember the concept. Can't say that anymore. We haven't been shut out. In fact, we're off the schneid, right? So I just want to start by asking each of you where you were when you saw that there was an official approval and what your initial reaction was, what you thought about first.
You know, I think most of us had been anticipating this and would have been short of a disaster if it wouldn't have been approved, or would have been really very, very disappointing. So we were all pretty sure it's going to happen. The question was, you know, exactly when. The PDUFA date was the approval date was yesterday. So I've been looking for it all day yesterday and sort of interact with my colleagues with text, some of whom were really close to this process. So it was amazing when it happened, just because, as you said, Roger, this has been something that we've been burned so many times in the past, and that's been really a difficult challenge to meet. And for that reason, and that reason only, not only that we have now a drug for a large proportion of patients that don't have an option right now, but also re-energizing this field of mass MASLD, or used to be called MAFLD and NASH, which was really getting a little bit labeled as a sort of impossible field. And I think to show that a drug can produce a great response was probably a very, very positive, not only for the efficacy that it has, but also for moving the field forward.
Points well taken. Next.
I wasn't sure what time it was going to happen. I thought it would come out first thing in the morning, and it got delivered quite late UK time, so even later German time. And it was a case of let's listen to the webcast and listening to Stephen Harrison there. It took me back to the reason you guys developed the podcast was to keep, with COVID, people aware of these clinical trials, keep the recruitment going. This is testament to the fact that did that work? Yes. Did we keep it in the agenda? Yes. So it's congratulations to Stephen and you and the team that originally started this, but also keeping people in the knowledge of this disease and the development as we were going along of fighting for any sort of knowledge base in the community. So that's where my thinking went first. Plus, it's not just a good day for fatty liver disease, but liver disease in general, as we start to look for one condition, we'll find fibrosis in other patients.
Duly noted. Oh, Jörn, you go next. You were...
No, I was going to say quickly and then pass it on to Ian that was actually up the day in Amsterdam. I was a little nervous about the day. I've reflected on the journey, and Zuberi Nussi is the better one to talk about it. I remember him presenting EASL data, Ocaliva, talking about the watershed moment, and I thought, you know, this must be happening again today. As he said, I expected it. The surrogate endpoints had been hit. This was the agreed conditions for conditional approval with the FDA. But on that day, I felt like, oh, what happens to the field, to the patients, to us, if this is not approved. You know, that nervosity carried me a little bit during the day, and I saw the ASLD message. I wondered about that too, so it was kind of a funny episode. I hope it didn't do any harm. And then after a full day, I think I was close to hitting close to my bedtime when actually I think 10:30 or 9:30 at night it came out. So I really just had a look this morning and studied the label even today. I know we're going to talk about that later. So I kind of slept through some of the excitement, and then I'm happy for us to have reached that point finally. I think the podcast went parallel with most of the clinical trial too. So it's really a great achievement, and I'm very happy to, you know, to be here to be discussing results and the day after an approved drug in MASH.
Absolutely. Ian, go ahead.
Yeah, I was at a radiology masterclass meeting yesterday with a room full of radiologists, and I told them confidently that this was going to be the most exciting day in hepatology for 10 years. There were a lot of blank faces looking back at me until I explained why that was actually going to be the case. It is really exciting, and even for those of us in Europe who obviously don't have access to treatment now, within my sort of network of colleagues and friends, we were exchanging messages and real excitement about what was to come and what we were going to be able to learn from, you know, marketing in the US and the way the treatment will develop.
You know, we were at GLI, we were doing what a lot of other people in the field were doing, which was constantly refreshing our screens on most of the day. You know, having had this experience with multiple federal agencies, I can't say that we didn't have some concern the longer in the day it went, but we do have seen almost like their standard operating procedure is that they're going to make the big announcement late in the day. And so that it came before 4:59:30 that afternoon, I think, was still earlier than what they're used to with this. And then we kind of spent the rest of the day, I mean, leading up to that, already beginning to field patient inquiries that were coming in, you know, people asking about questions that are answered in the labeling, but, you know, it will be part of our next steps and part of the engagement and conversations that we'll be doing, building on the episode, the live episode we just did with Louise on GLI Live, to kind of start addressing some of these questions around access, about what the patient population is, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, the buzz was creating buzz on it, if you will.
Yeah, buzz tends to amplify. It's true. Particularly good buzz. Jörn, I had the same experience you had at one point in the morning, thinking back to Zuberi presenting Ocaliva data years ago and how excited we all were about that the first time and saying, no, that can't be happening again. So I spent the rest of the day in a state of what I'm going to call modified optimism. And the first thought I had when I saw the release was, phew, now we don't have to worry about this. We have lots of new things to worry about, but they're all good worries. In the battle of good worries and bad worries, worries. We've now gone from the bad worries to the good worries. And the call I fielded right after that was from an investor buddy who was really impressed that we don't need to do biopsy, but immediately asked me, does that mean payers are going to require MRI-PDFF on everybody? And I said, hey, take a deep breath. This is going to be easier than that. You got to step back from everything you were afraid of and approach it a little bit differently. And then, so here we are today. Hey, all good. So one of the questions I had for the treating physicians is when you actually read the labeling, actually everybody except me, when you actually read the labeling, did a specific patient or type of patient come to mind immediately as somebody you would want to have this for quickly, U.S., or as quickly as you can elsewhere, or something about how the target changed because of what was and wasn't in the labeling?
The obvious thought I had driving this morning is I want to use it in my advanced patients first, the ones that are F3, and I want to prevent cirrhosis. And then I sit back, said, you know, I discussed with Ian a lot of times, how can I separate the cirrhotic patient using NITs from the non-cirrhotic patients? And then I had to take a deep breath and think about it and say, well, I need to put some more brains into that and decide on which NITs to be used. And I'm not sure, Ian, how you wanted to approach it, but I think that's the art moving forward, you know, of how to qualify the F2, F3 non-cirrhotic patients with the NITs we have.
Yeah, if I may add to that, I think that I thought about two patients. I thought about that patient that Joern is talking about the F3 trying to prevent them from becoming cirrhotic. The labeling on this is very explicit about how it's supposed to be used in conjunction with physical activity and nutrition or diet and exercise, as they call it in that way as well. And so that made me think about people that are now moving into a state, you know, F2, that are going to be more serious, but that it really pushes us into, okay, now we have a tool to help support the physical activity and nutrition efforts that you're making as well.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I mean, the F2s and F3s are sort of the ones that I would certainly focus on. I actually think that we have to be very cautious not to go off label and include patients with more advanced liver disease. I think we're just, until we have better safety data, we should not really get ourselves into a situation where we have to explain things. And as you know, in the past, it has happened. And this disease, not this disease, but other diseases that you are familiar with drugs that are approved. So I caution people that we need to stick with the data that we have. And I think in terms of, I'll say what I would use for NITs, and I think this is really, as long as we follow the guidance that we have, how to determine the F2s and F3s using with the initial test. And then my second line test is that I really use the FibroScan or a transelastography and an ELF test as frequently as I can. And sometimes, you know, we may have to use both if you have this prep. And I rarely go to liver biopsy, and I would not go to liver biopsy, and I would rarely go to MRE. That's because it's not really practical to do MREs in a lot of places because people are waiting for months to get MRI of their head for with this or that. So it's not even actually capacity-wise, it's not possible. I actually think that, you know, historically we've had issues with lifestyle intervention just because it was very difficult to, people are not used to think about lifestyle as a prescription. The same way you're prescribing a statin to someone, telling somebody you're going to go lose 10 pounds and come back in 6 months, that means absolutely nothing. So it may actually, this will, could prompt the practitioners to now say that, well, this is a red regimen, and that regimen should be done with these things, and then bring in the type of other successful opportunities for folks in terms of nutrition, exercise, and other programs that then can be connected to the drug and make it much more effective. And I think when you have a pill, and then you can say, well, this is not something that you're going to just, now that you have an injection, you can just inject yourself and forget about what you eat. This is the same way. You're not just going to take the pill and just forget about everything else. So it will give us an opportunity to enhance that message, that message of lifestyle intervention is as important now and probably more important now than before, because you've got something, I don't have a lot of data for this at the moment, that I would suspect that the efficacy of this regimen would be even better if you can effectively implement lifestyle. I think those are the messages that can be now packaged to patients in much more logical way that patients may understand now that there's a disease and as a drug, but also as another piece to it that needs to be worked on.
I agree, Zubair. Two quick comments, Roger, before I get back to you. I think, you know, lifestyle and dietary education was part of the phase 3 trial. I agree, across different continents, it's probably very diverse how this was enforced. The label, the way it reads, is actually very similar to the other U.S. labels, as far as I'm aware. For example, in the GLP-1, it says this is indicated as an adjunct to diet and exercise to improve glycemic control in adults with type 2 diabetes, is what it reads on the GLP-1 label. So I think for metabolic drugs, this is
the typical wording the FDA uses to highlight that there's an underlying need for lifestyle and exercise.
And I completely agree. I think that's in the label, and I think there should have been a label. But on the other hand, it's always difficult to make it reality in the practice. And I think that's what, you know, sort of, you know, coming to some consensus with different guidance that we have, that we now have to provide the providers and the patients with tools that they can use. I mean, right now it's US only, but in the future, but even in the US, not everybody eats the same kind of food. If you can't tell somebody in some part of the country in the United States to just go eat Mediterranean food, that's not culturally sensitive or appropriate. I think what we need to do is to understand what that means and actually make it so that those folks understand how to actually eat the diet that they've been eating, but eat it healthy. And what does healthy mean with different types of recipes and diets from different sort of backgrounds, and what does activity mean? And as you know, Jorn is a part of the Global NASH Council, and we really are putting in big effort to sort of develop both provider and patient material that then can be used in terms of what is the right lifestyle modification that is geographically appropriate, culturally appropriate, and then also can be applied. And that's the guideline that's being actually put together. And for lifestyle, Shiraz Zarvasagi is the one who's leading from the Global NASH Council that effort, and that should be available by summer of this year.
So before I kick this over to Jeff, I have one brief comment from 25 years of marketing research, which is that community physicians, virtually regardless of whether they're primary care or specialty, when given diet and exercise as their only tool, basically say they've got nothing. But if you give them a drug so that it's diet and exercise literally as an adjunct to medication, flip the script on this. It's not the medication is the adjunct. The medication is what drives the behavior. Diet and exercise are an adjunct. I'm where Bear was a minute ago, which is at that point, I think people take it a lot more seriously. And I think we'll see a much greater effort, particularly among community physicians who've got less time to treat and may have a less powerful motivation to think about steatotic liver disease all day, to actually bring diet and exercise to those conversations a lot more aggressively. And I believe that's part of the benefit that we'll get from this.
Roger, frankly, you just about made my point in this, which was that what I anticipate in this, and I think what you're saying as well, is that this will also be helpful in terms of reducing stigma. Because when you are given, from a patient perspective, if you're given a prescription of lose 10 pounds, just diet and exercise, there is a big sort of, well, if you just have the willpower, you know, you need to go do right and lose some weight on this. But once you're able to add a medication into the recipe of what is coming from your provider on this, then it suddenly kind of medicalizes the behavior and the lifestyle changes that need to happen. And that's really, really significant. It takes it away from like, well, this is just willpower and I'm a bad human being, to suddenly a treatment regimen that the provider is somebody that the patient can then go to or look for other experts to be able to seek support from. And that's going to be something that's really significant going forward with this.
Just to follow up with what Jeff said, we have this stigma, the original stigma paper in Internal Hepatology a couple of months ago, but in the past few days, we have the impact of stigma and liver disease burden on quality of life. But when you look at liver disease burden, patient with fatty liver disease, self-blame is a major part of actually the package they carry with themselves. So I think it's going to be really important in that context. In the United States, I have to say that, yes, gastroenterologists will be prescribing, and they should be the target of education so that they can actually understand the importance of the drug and how to use it, when not to use it, and how to, you know, all those things that's going to be important. But in the United States, it's the target audience will be our advanced practitioners. Advanced practitioners in the United States treat patients with, you know, early liver disease, at least. So, and even, you know, by early liver disease, I mean even F3s. They're engaged with patients with cirrhosis and advanced cirrhosis and liver transplantation. But I think those are the folks that need to be engaged. And thank God, actually, they were probably a lot easier to bring, not only the medication side, but the lifestyle intervention side. They are the ones who could connect with the nutrition, with behavioral health, with exercise specialists, those kind of things that are not always available in any system, but at least there may be a few things available that they can actually utilize to bring folks together. So I'm very enthusiastic to support the gastroenterology for the U.S., gastroenterology and the APPs, to make sure they are aware of the regimen and the lifestyle intervention that will go with it.
So let me step back for a second and welcome our friend Laurent Castera, who has been able to arrive and get himself connected. Laurent, how are you this evening?
How are you? First of all, I would like to apologize for being late, but my train arrived late, and I'm very happy to be there and to see many familiar faces.
And a bit of a celebration, eh, Laurent?
Absolutely. Incredible news. And I want to repeat, because I'm sure you already commented, so I'm trying to catch up.
I guess the question we're kind of on right now is how this will be integrated into treatment. You know, obviously in the U.S. where we can use it now, it'll be a little bit different. But what do you foresee? What were the challenges, the patient types that you're thinking about right now today on the other side of the approval?
Of course, I mean, we're going to have time to give some thought about it because it won't come to Europe before a while. My take is that, first, I think it's a very good news for patients because this has been long awaited. And of course, it's going to change the field. I think also this is good news, even for the patient that we won't be able to treat for the time being in Europe, because this is going to bring a lot of attention on MASLD and the fact that there will be a treatment, because this is usually what GPs say, you know, when you discuss with them, they say, yeah, okay, you know, it's not very high on my agenda because I'm looking for the diabetes, I'm looking for hypertension, I'm looking for obesity, and liver is really low on my agenda. And why should I screen this disease? Because there is no treatment. So at least now there's a treatment, and I think we can use it as a leverage to increase the awareness of MASLD outside of the liver field. And I think this is very important. The second point is that it seems that the label comes without a liver biopsy. So this is a major shift. I mean, of course, as experts, we've been prepared. But again, outside, let's say beyond the liver field, I think it's going to be a very important message to convey that we do not stick anymore to liver biopsy and that we might use non-invasive tests to select patients.
So as you joined a couple of minutes ago, Jorn asked Ian a question that Ian never got around to having an opportunity to answer because we've jumped in.
I put him on the spot. He doesn't have to answer because it's a tough one.
No, but this is Ian. He usually has an answer. If you don't have an answer, Ian, it's fine.
I've got an answer. I mean, the answer is that I don't really know. But I mean, I think Lauren's arrived at the perfect moment, though, because we were talking about how you can use non-invasive tests to confidently identify people who've got F2 or F3, but exclude patients who've got cirrhosis. Because as Zubair said, you know, there are concerns about not using the medicine off-label in people who've got more advanced disease so that we don't either encounter unanticipated hepatotoxicity and cause a threat to continued use of the drug. So first thing that I did yesterday was to dive into some of our local data of patients who've been biopsied who've got Fib4, ELF and FibroScan to try and look at what the probability of significant or advanced fibrosis that isn't cirrhosis would be present in those patients. And actually, it looks like it's as difficult as I thought, which is really quite difficult. Lauren, what do you think?
Of course, as everyone knows, among experts present here tonight, is that distinguishing F3 from F4 is a bit tricky, including with liver biopsy. But on the other hand, as you know, it's fibrosis is a continuum. It's not like MASH, because MASH is going like this and fibrosis is a continuum. And again, I've been working for now more than 20 years in NIT. So, of course, this is I'm very happy today because I can anticipate there's going to be a shift in the way people are seeing liver disease and especially MASLD. And we're moving from a categorical scale, F1, F2, F3, F4, that is actually ABCD, because you're not 1.2 or 1.5. You're either 1 or 2 or 3 or 4. And we know, of course, what makes the difference is 3 and 4, because it puts you at risk of developing liver-related event and increased mortality. So back to NIT, of course, this may be challenging how you're going to define people that are F2, F3 and not F4. On the other hand, it's obvious that liver stiffness will be one of the key NIT that we're going to use because we've been using it already. And then I think we need to stick to clinical practice and to make it simple. Let me take an example. Several years ago, Baveno has proposed the concept of CACLD, compensated advanced chronic liver disease, starting when you're 10 kilopascal. Then, of course, your liver stiffness increases, and we know that it's like a prediction scale, you know? The likelihood of developing events, of course, will increase with the liver stiffness. So first of all, I think we need to be relaxed with the cutoff. And I'm a bit sick with this cutoff of 12.25. Doesn't really make sense. You're 12, 13. And you need also to repeat because we know there's some variability when you're using liver stiffness. So at least you probably will need, like was included in the Baveno definition, at least two measurements that are consistent before you can make a decision. Ideally, also, you would need another non-related or unrelated marker. And this we can discuss further afterwards. Coming back to the cutoff, I think it's not unreasonable to have an upper limit around 20, because this is where things are changing and the likelihood of having cirrhosis is much higher. But you might use a very simple algorithm like, again, Baveno with a platelet count. And let's say you have a patient with 30 kilopascal and 80,000 platelet counts. It's pretty obvious that this patient has cirrhosis. And of course, you put it in context, because if the guy is 60 years old, he has a high metabolic burden, the likelihood even increase. Whereas if it's a young guy with no metabolic burden, it's more unlikely. So context, platelet count, liver stiffness, you repeat, and I think you're on the safe side. Last but not least, from the data we have so far, the drug is pretty safe in cirrhotic patients, provided they're compensated. So I think this is probably, I mean, this is just speculation, of course, because I actually value what Joran or Zobair would think, or Jan. I don't want to monopolize.
We landed right in your wheelhouse, though, Laurent. So that wasn't monopolization. That was
you came on at the right time, Laurent. That's great.
Yeah, that was timing and expertise at work.
And I have to say, I agree with the thrombocytes. I think in clinics, I rely on them, and I like to see them repeatedly, and I can judge thrombocyte movement in a patient, assessing their, as Laurent said, progression towards more advanced disease, which is a continuum, not as fluctuating. And if you have this, in addition, with maybe even an LT-AST ratio showing some shifts and FibroScan. So it's not going to be one marker, I think. It's going to be clinical judgment based on number of NITs. Maybe you have to factor in how obese the patient is, how valid the FibroScan reading is. Look at the confidence intervals or the interquartile range and then make a decision. But the label is so that we can do that. It allows us to do that. And for that reason, I think it's a good label for clinical use and patients.
I agree with Laurent with you, of course. I think the two tests sort of confirmation, especially for some of these tests are so easy to do these days, would be the way to go. And also looking at the clinical profile of the patient and making sure that, you know, I don't need to do a FibroScan to tell me if a patient has a platelet count is low or has an imaging of the abdomen that shows lots of collaterals. That patient has portal hypertension. I think the drug is probably safe in early cirrhotics and very well compensated cirrhotics. However, I'm going to stick with the prescribing sort of recommendation that we have. And I think the whole idea here in the discussion we're having as to how to really separate F3s from F4s, because the F4s are going to be the one, quote unquote, with compensated cirrhosis. I think what Laurent just said, and Jorn, confirmed that looking at two NITs, being flexible in terms of your thresholds, erring on the side of being safe and looking at a patient, making sure that the clinical laboratory signs are not clearly to tell you that the patient has portal hypertension or, you know, more significant fibrosis than F3. That I think is the way to go for now.
I completely agree with you, Zobair. I think also, of course, imaging and especially ultrasound is maybe informative, but it needs to be in good hand because, as you know, the specificity is good, but the sensitivity, depending on who is performing ultrasound, if it's an experienced, of course, ultrasonographer, it's okay. But I would even go maybe to CT scan sometimes when you have any doubt. Because if you have splenomegaly or collaterals, of course, there is portal hypertension and we're in a different league. So I think this is critical. Now, regarding the second test, this is a difficult question because FIB4 is, I think, very efficient in primary care because of its high negative predictive value. It's very simple, but still you're using platelet counts, so you overlap. But in a specialized setting, I would be cautious because data we have showed that there's about 30% of false negative with a FIB4 in a context of high prevalence of fibrosis. So I would be cautious. So you probably need a more specialized test. So one would qualify, of course, is the ELF test, but it's not widely available. So maybe in the US, it will be easier, but in Europe or other part of the world. And also it comes with a cost and you need a platform to perform it. But the nice thing about the ELF score, it's unrelated. What I mean is, for instance, we know that the drawback of FibroScan are false positive in general, and especially in patients with obesity, let's say a BMI above 35 or 40, there's high risk of false positive. Whereas ELF is not influenced by BMI. So this is okay. And the limitation of ELF are not the same that for elastography. So if the two NITs go in the same direction, I think you're on the safe side. But of course, it's a trade-off between accuracy and feasibility in your practice.
Okay. I'm listening to this conversation, and one of the thoughts I'm having is that this entire discussion about NITs is about to shift because it's going to wind up not only with the folks who have the tremendous experience that you folks have, but we're now going to be looking at hepatologists and APPs who are actually going to be doing prescribing. I used to tell my drug clients that every new drug gets two sets of clinical trials. One is the one that gets you approved. And then the second is what happens in the hands of all the individual physicians who use it. And if the labeling says what it says, but the drug doesn't work that way in the hands of the physician will form her or his own impressions, and that's where they're going to be. I suspect we'll see something similar to that here with NITs. And one of the questions I've got is where, and I'll start with Jeff and Louise on this and then go back to the physicians. Where do you think the education will come from on how to think about issues of testing properly? You know, I mean, we heard Bill Siebold yesterday on the webcast give a pretty compelling list of all the things that their reps and MSLs are going to be working on, the magical reps and MSLs. But this wasn't necessarily one of them. So I'm wondering where you think that kind of insight and that kind of education is likely to come from and what each of us can do to facilitate it. Because if folks don't get the NITs right, this isn't going to be the experience it could be.
I think I'll go first and then leave it to Jeff. In the context of yesterday, they showed a lovely roadmap, and it's about physician education. By the time a patient often gets to a physician, they've already seen a nurse, they've already had their FibroScan, they've already interacted with the main areas of contact who will spend more time with them, given the limited amount of time a physician has to advise. So the collating all of that information is important. So therefore, giving the message of F2, F3 fibrosis, dietary information, and what's required with this medication is actually going to be given at an earlier time point. So it's about all practitioner areas being educated, because when a physician, or most of the physicians I've ever worked for, the better educated the patient is walking through the door, the easier it makes that conversation. And the patient should be the expert in their condition. It engages somebody. It allows them to be part and feel in control and ask the right questions. Because what happens is if that doesn't happen, they come back to us as practitioners to ask us the questions. If we're not educated, we can't make those answers. We can't find the right information. So I think it's an all-person practice education for me. The concern for me would be non-invasive technologies going out without specialist delivery to endocrinology, cardiology, who now will have an opportunity to screen for disease. And that for me is the strength of what we provide, or where you go to a specialist provider, where you can discuss the serial testing of NITs and what they mean and why they're being done. So my concern would be only focusing on practitioners. But that might be just the start, because it's going to be practitioners prescribing these drugs to start before advanced practitioners or nurse practitioners in the UK and Germany and elsewhere in Europe. So that would be my concern about that education at the moment. But you've got Sunil Hosman now, the head of the NIT side. You've got some very good practitioners going in on the education team that I'm aware of. So I'm reassured by the level of education and the knowledge of the people being used. So that helps.
Yeah, thank you, Louise. I think you gave some form to my initial whirlwind of thoughts on this issue, which is, you know, I think as you've heard me complain about previously, Roger, is, you know, if there's one thing that the field does really well is that it points its finger at other places and says, you guys need to do this. And we've done it with primary care. We've done it with patients. We do it with providers. It just kind of happens all over the place, you know. And so we've come to this junction where one of the things that we've relied on in the past is, well, once we have a drug, then that's the miracle that will occur that will answer all of these other questions. And I do think it will be an answer in this. But in terms of all of this kind of circling back to education about non-invasives, you know, I do think there is a huge patient role in this. But I think it's, you know, there's no question. If you have a more educated, empowered patient coming into the clinic under any condition, and frankly, for any disease state, with good questions, the better that experience and the better that those outcomes are going to be, not just in this instance as well. I think it's interesting to say that in this, that, you know, you can use, when you look at the labeling on this, non-invasive invasives are shown, but you know, you can use non-invasives with other indicators. It's not solely reliable on non-invasives in terms of this. We're all very happy that biopsy isn't required, but if you kind of flip that to say, okay, what non-invasive? We still haven't really landed on that non-invasive. You know, we still haven't really landed on what's that one thing. We talk about fiber scans, we talk about blood tests, we talk about these other things, but they're still not that quite at that degree of specificity. And so we need to continue the education kind of all around on this, that patients can be better informed about the non-invasives and that the providers can be better informed to be able to use the non-invasives with another indicator of some sort to really help funnel the patients most at need here.
Let me just make a couple of comments. I think we just have to sort of be realistic about what is possible and what is going to be the sweet spot of what we're going to be dealing with, at least where we're starting with in the United States. The majority of patients initially would be in the GI practices. And of course, some hepatology, but primarily in the GI practices. They're waiting for something, so they have to actually be accessed. So these will be in phases. The education stuff that we're going to do would be in phases. I think as much as we can do in terms of patient education should parallel any phases on the provider side. But on the provider side, initially, it has to be on the gastroenterology and their APP side. That's where they need help. That's what hepatologists understand, resmetirom and indication. We're all on board and we can treat, and our APPs are pretty much on board. It's going to be the gastroenterologist. I'm afraid if I go now and start pushing the primary care physicians to start screening, I don't even have the capacity to treat the patients that could potentially come or evaluate them and risk stratify them using one of the algorithms to get them to treatment, because it's going to be limitation of what we have in terms of capacity of hepatology in the United States. So I think this year, 2024, would be focused on the gastroenterologists and develop the material that then you can use to convince the primary care physicians. The endocrinologists are increasingly on board. In the United States, ACE, which is American Association for Clinical Endocrinology, has a guidance document, a guideline that's been around, and they're on board. ADA is writing one right now. I'm a member of the committee, and it's going to come out pretty soon. And then you have the European Diabetes sort of Society that Michael Roden and Amelia Gastaldi and others are actually putting together. So that would probably be a little bit sort of later during the year and at the end of and the beginning of next year. But I think we need to sort of learn from these educational programs, make it stepwise so that it's effective and targeted, but also doesn't overwhelm us as the practitioners and providers to then be the, otherwise we would shoot ourselves in the leg. You know, we're making sure that Madrigal could produce the drugs that we want and enough of the drug that we want. And all of those things need some more time to be gelled. And I'm actually focusing in the next 6 months to develop educational sort of programs for the gastroenterologists. And as Jorn and Lauren is our co-chair of the committee for the NIT, for the Global NASH Council, they are actually going to be involved. And, you know, there are discrepancies still in terms of what second test do you have to use. Some of it is because of sort of guidelines looking different way at the same evidence. Some of it is reality of what you have available. If you don't have ELF available, you can put it 50,000 times on the second line test. It won't be used. So let's go to the reality of what's available in, you know, country X or region Y of the United States. And if they have Shearwave that's more available, then that should be Shearwave. I think we have to make it available so that we don't actually create barriers based on slight bit of difference in terms of evidence. We have to use the best evidence, but also be practical, as Laurent said, what is available and use that is available, even if it may not be the perfect test.
If I may say, I completely agree with Dr. Yannassi on that as well. I think it begs a question of when we talk about education, it's education to what point, to what outcome? And we can educate about non-invasives. We can educate, I mean, hell, we need to educate about the liver and NASH and, you know, all these sort of things as well. But I don't know that that is the next step in this. And so there's a fine line here between our next step needing to be education, but our next step also needs to be identification of patients. And so to Dr. Yannassi's comments, we need to be able to identify the patients that are already in the system, and then to be able to work with a gastroenterologist to be able to make sure that they're aware of the medication that the patients already in the system can receive. And so that speaks then to education of the gastroenterologist. It speaks to the education of the patients that are already in the already diagnosed and already in the system. And we know this is underdiagnosed. And so there needs to be a ramp up of diagnosing those folks that have NASH that aren't aware of it right now. But I think it also then very quickly goes into the reimbursement question about that as well, of being able to educate payers on this also.
Yeah, the good part about that is that through all the trials and even now in the label, resmetirom has been a very safe drug. There's been no major concerns in the presentation of the label yesterday. There's some hints regarding looking out for gallbladders and decompensated cirrhosis, gallbladder stones, and so on. But it seemed very safe. And while I share Zobair's concern that if you're outside of an expert's hand, there might be more use that's more lax, I think it's very important we tell people to not use it, in particular decompensated cirrhosis at all, then the label doesn't sound very complicated. I think it's manageable.
Just to follow up, I actually agree completely with you, Jorn. It seems to me that is a very, very safe drug. In the clinical trial, when you have gallstone, I mean, it's a gallstone because, you know, these patients are at risk for gallstone because they are obese. So it may not even actually be related, but it's been reported. So I think making the point that drug is generally very safe. We presented data for about quality of life on a phase 2 of this drug. There was improvement of quality of life of patients who were responding. When you go from efficacy to effectiveness, you go to the real world setting. I err on the side of being more cautious, not to worry about any side effects, but just to understand this, how people are going to use it in the real world. Because, you know, not all of the practitioners will be that careful. And I don't want to have a situation where our first drug in this field get a black eye because somebody did not actually understand that you can't use it with a drug that can involve the CYP pathways of enzymes that could potentially, you know, worsen toxicity. So I think we just have to be careful. And that's the reason that my first push is for F2s and F3s. That's in there. But I'm comforted with the fact that in my estimation, even there were some concerns, and I saw the report about, well, maybe the thyroid issue. There is no evidence that this is a completely different, my close friend wrote an editorial in one of the major journals, but I love him. But I think the reality is that there is so much data right now that the drug has great safety profile. And some of the things that you see is part of the clinical trial scrutiny. Now, of course, any drug can cause toxicity. Obviously, you can take, drug over the counter and can harm yourself. But I think in general and total, it's a safe drug. I'm erring on the side of safety for now until I have more effectiveness data to say that. And there's more evidence on more advanced patients. Hopefully that'll come at some point that could be expanded. So I share your enthusiasm, Jorn. I'm as enthusiastic as you are.
Laurent, let me try to tie a couple things together, and then I'm going to ask all of you to respond to what I'm saying, and then I got one or two more questions. There's this interesting dynamic at play here. The dynamic goes like this. We don't want to give this drug to cirrhotic patients. We want to do only F2s and F3s, but we have a very hard time figuring out where the border is between F3 and compensated cirrhosis. Laurent, that was in the conversation before you got here, but it was a concern that both Jorn and Ian voiced. At that point, the safety of the drug becomes pivotal because it suggests you can miss by a little, right? You can go into early child PUA and you're probably okay. You're not going to lose patients that way, which doesn't mean we should be more casual about that, Zobair. I think you're right, F2, F3, but it doesn't make it quite so scary that you be so precise at a point in time when the precision of the tools isn't that good. And I think that, to me, that was probably the major benefit of how strong the safety profile was on this drug, or is on this drug. Laurent, I didn't mean to jump in front of you. Go ahead, and then I got one more question for everybody.
No, I just wanted to echo what Zobair say. I mean, this is a general rule for phase 3 study. How can you extrapolate this result to real world? And you just have to be aware that the data we have are in a super selected population that may not be completely representative of patients that will be seen in the real world. But this is always the same. When the drugs come to the market, it always happens. On the other hand, I think we're pretty confident that, I mean, it's safe in compensated cirrhosis. It's easy to use. Side effects are mild. Of course, you might end up when you treat 10,000 patients to toxicity or DDI or whatever. But I'm pretty confident also, like Zobair mentioned. There will be also the same process for using NIT, because most of the literature and the evidence we have regarding NIT comes from expert center like ours. And we need now to go beyond the liver clinic, and this will be a learning process and interesting to see how this NIT perform in a larger scale or in other setting like in endocrinology or in the diabetes clinic. But from my experience now working for 5 years, having a liver clinic in the diabetes this clinic. Our colleagues really adopted this method, and then now they're using it. They perform a fiber scan to every diabetic patient once a year. Every time they suspect there is already advanced liver disease, they refer to us, and it works very well. And I think this will be the way to go, because the low-hanging fruit also for patients are patients in the endocrinology clinic. But there will be a lot of education ahead, and I completely agree. I mean, we are aligned with Zobair, because this is something we've been working on now for a while. It's very important to provide good education. And you need to have a frame when using, of course, this drug and this NIT.
So about half of this audience is where I wanted to go. And thanks, Laurent. That's a fantastic comment. I think all the comments have been fantastic. You guys have been great. About 40 to 50% of our audience are people who work in drug companies or biotechs, either in drug development or early commercialization. If you had that role, what would you take out of the process of getting here and what that label says and the things we've been talking about today? How would that affect your work?
This company did the right thing and was persistent in doing the right thing for years, even when they were not at the forefront of the field. There were others, as you remember. But by that, I mean, you're doing the right studies with the right design and not relying on small sample size, you know, sample size driven phase two clinical trial and just bidding big in that. I think you just have to do your due diligence. The second thing that I think they did was to introduce non-invasive tests as endpoint of the studies. You know, mastery or NAFLD was a major effort. And even at the time that a lot of people didn't really agree with that, they were realistic. They had good foresight to see that when you have a drug, you're not going to be able to use liver biopsy at the end of 1 year treatment. So they introduced this idea that NITs could be used for potential treatment and monitoring. And that, I think that separated them very well from others, that they thought outside the box and they had good foresight to do this. And I think those things will set them apart.
Other messages for corporate folks. And Zobair, that's an excellent one. Thank you.
So I think that's very interesting. And it's something that I think I mentioned to Roger after we recorded the last round of the podcast that I was on about, you know, how important the parallel Maestro-NAFLD was in the approval and the lack of liver biopsy on the label. Because if lots of supportive information has come for that, is that saying to companies, yeah, you know, you've got to do your licensing endpoint studies with liver biopsy, but actually you've got to do a parallel non-invasive test study in a more real-world population as well? Or is this precedent set that biopsy-proven patients will give you a label where liver biopsy is no longer required?
Well, I think they set the stage, and whether everyone has to do the same thing is probably not going to be required to do a Maestro and NAFLD type of study. I'm hoping that in the near future that the agencies will accept some at least NITs as real endpoints and not rely on liver biopsy. That's not the case right now, and I don't see that happening immediately. But at least it gives us some evidence that when you do NIT trial and then you actually do a real trial that the agency is going to require it, and you do it right, you see the efficacy happening on both type of endpoints. And then you can, you know, at least I'm convinced, you know, forget about how the approval process goes. As a clinician, I'm convinced that the NIT data will support me to use it for treatment and monitoring of patients. That evidence may not have been a part of the package for submission, or it may have been. I'm not privy to that information. But it is really important for clinicians to know that happened. And we saw that the efficacy, you know, that was part of the NIT data that was shown with Maestro and NAFLD. And also, the other thing, of course, was that Maestro and NAFLD was a larger spectrum of the disease. So you capture all kinds of other things that you may not be able to capture in much more restricted sort of population. So these are all positives for a company that put a lot of effort into doing the right thing.
Okay. Go ahead, Louise.
I just wonder, looking back 12 months, how pivotal that day or 2-day session with the FDA was. There were excellent sessions presented about non-invasive data and the role of non-invasive data. And that was a 2-day meeting run by the FDA. So they had lots of evidence to be able to consider and take into account before they made this ruling. And I wonder, looking back, how actually pivotal that was in the in yesterday's eventual ruling?
It's a great question. Anybody have an answer? And then we're well past an hour, so I kind of do want to go to close in a moment.
I think FDA has been, and I'm right outside Washington, D.C., so it's been, I've been watching, and I do have interaction with my friends there. It's been a process for FDA to understand the importance of NITs. It's a journey, and I think they're getting there. It's slow, painful for some of us. You know, remember, hepatology was based on liver biopsies. That's how hepatologists were. You could never actually imagine a time where you do hepatology sort of trials without liver biopsy, because most of the great name hepatologists, Heinz Zimmermann or others, they knew more about the pathology than anybody else. So I think we have come to this over time, and a lot of people in the FDA are from these institutions, but they're getting there. I give them a lot of credit. This is not easy, and they're making the change, but they're making it very carefully, and they're making it, but they're going in the right direction, and I applaud them for that.
So, Bear, great comment on which to close the roundtable. I just got one question for everybody. Anything we haven't talked about today that's come through your mind in the last couple of days as we've been, as the drug's gotten approved? Anything at all?
I'm just going to chip in on something that was discussed yesterday. Women are the leading cause of transplant for muscles and MASH. And it was highlighted in the session. When we're looking at who to start to find the disease in, we need to start to stop this. We need to treat women as a high-risk postmenopausal women. We need to stop them getting and driving this transplant list. We don't get transplanted as frequently, and we don't do as well. So we really have to look at that. And the ethnicity issue of looking for ethnicities who progress to cirrhosis and through cirrhosis at double the speed of Caucasian. So we need to be picking up populations, for me, that are at higher risk within the populations that we're going to be treating, which goes back to what Jean was saying at the beginning.
Excellent. Thanks, Louise. Other thoughts?
I'll say a couple of things to close my thoughts, is that this is the first step and a journey. We can address certain aspects of the disease with a drug, even with lifestyle, but the epidemic, the pandemic, global pandemic of this disease is not going to go away unless we actually sort of pair this up with national policies, global policies at WHO, making sure it's part of non-communicable diseases. We educate our payers, our politicians, and everyone else to sort of not only make the drug that is effective and safe available, but also help us with food insecurities, with other issues that promote this disease. Ultimately, I think I'm very enthusiastic about this drug, partly because of this and what Yuan and Laurent and Ian and Jeff and everyone else have been saying, is that it is also sort of getting more enthusiasm and energy in an area that's been sort of deflated for the past year or two. So I'm hoping that those things will happen. If those that not happen, then I'm afraid we're going to just make a small dent and will not feel it as a society. And ultimately, most patients will not be, you know, benefit from drugs like this.
To tie the couple of last comments together, Roger, if I may, I think one of the things that I got a lot of excitement out of, aside of the specific announcement from the FDA of Madrigal, was seeing kind of all the buzz that's happened over the past week to 10 days leading up to this with other companies. I mean, we're seeing that Inventiva has now resumed their trial. There was a little hiccup there that they've gotten sorted out. I'm seeing tons of announcements of people that are eager to kind of get into this zeitgeist in order to make sure that they, you know, get a little bit of their piece of the pie. We're seeing announcements on positive results in phase 1 and 2A trials that are coming out on social a lot more so. And so I'm seeing kind of the rising tide lifting all boats in this. And I think that that points to something kind of specific in this, which is that people are excited not just because Madrigal got across the line at the FDA, but they're seeing that there has been more than just finger pointing, if you will, as I referred to earlier, with the FDA needs to do this or primary care needs to do that. But there's actually been more concentrated liver health advocacy over the past couple of years that really came about from previous lessons learned, if you will. When you look at what happened with Madrigal versus prior incarnations, the distinction is really, I mean, aside of their clinical results, but it's that safety profile that is something that really stands out, along with the non-invasive stuff as well. But it's that safety profile. And if we go back earlier on, you know, GLI held a FDA requested, but held a FDA externally led patient focused drug development meeting. When you go back and look at that transcript, everything that they talk about is non-invasives and safety, non-invasives and safety in that. And so for us, you know, from our patient advocacy standpoint, what we see is that the market has been de-risked for liver health investment through effective liver health advocacy writ large on this. And I think that's the positive that we're coming out from this.
Great comment, Jeff. Thanks. Laurent, Ian, Jorn, anything to add? Go ahead.
One last short comment. So being working for 20 years in NIT, today for me it's a special day because I think shifting to NIT has been a small step for us and FDA, but a giant leap for patients.
Thank you, Astronaut Castera, that's well analogized. Ian, Jorn?
I've got one comment, and I don't want to be at all negative around today, but I think it's really important that the integrity of the trial is maintained until its actual conclusion. The licensing yesterday was conditional, and with all of the excitement, patients who are enrolled in the trial, where although it's blinded, it may be clear to investigators and perhaps even patients that when the ALT hasn't fallen, that maybe they're not on the active drug. You know, those patients have to be encouraged and supported to stay within the trial. Otherwise, we will never find out what the true efficacy of this drug and perhaps many others in the future really is or are.
Excellent point. Jorn?
Yeah, one more to say. I think this was a fascinating discussion on a topic that really moved us because after a long journey, we've come to a point where there is an approved drug that's safe and we have figured out diagnostics, how to implement them and use the drug. Very excited to see and learn from the ALS colleagues. Be a little bit more time, but my understanding is that the EMA region will see resmetirom, hopefully maybe early next year. In that time, there's going to be a lot of learning and education needed. The work Zubair is doing with the Global NASH Council, reaching out, educating people, and I'm very, very excited to be here.
Okay. So first of all, thanks to all of you. I have two closing thoughts. First of all, when folks talk about systems theory and they don't really want to get into any details, they give the example of a butterfly flaps its wings in Tokyo and 3 days later, there's a rainstorm in Chicago. This was the butterfly. And my point is that we are frequently way too confident about the linear paths that things are going to take. This can veer off in so many different directions that I think it's appropriate for all of us to act with integrity and caution going forward. And caution in terms of lack of hubris and not being certain that you're right, because who knows, right? That's number one. Number two, I wasn't going to say this, but Zober brought me back to it. When we started this podcast, Stephen Harrison described his mission as putting a big fat dent in fatty liver disease. And I say to our colleagues, Stephen, that if yesterday wasn't putting a dent in liver disease, we've got to make it as big a dent as possible as Zober. I think you got that one right. But if yesterday wasn't a signal day for putting a dent in liver disease, I don't know what is. And he and Madrigal and the other researchers are all to be commended because, boy, 4 years ago, nobody I knew thought this was going to get there. And here we are. So welcome to the changed world audience. Thanks all of you for joining. Louise and I will be back, I think not you, Aaron, and Jeff, actually, on Monday with some of the other patient advocates to talk about how the patient advocates are reacting to this. And then we'll be back over the next couple of weeks with more episodes about exactly how the world has changed. But I can't think of a better crew of people to have kicked it off. I'll be back with the question of the week and business report in just a couple of minutes. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Cheers.
Safe travels to Missy.
Bye-bye.
And now, here's Roger with this week's question of the week.
Now, our question of the week. How do you anticipate the ability of Rezdiffra will affect your work related to MASH and Mazel D? Hepatologists, when will you start prescribing it and for what kind of patients? Endocrinologists in primary care, do you anticipate educating and screening more patients? And when you screen, what tests will you use? Clinical researchers, how might this affect the research that you do or the funds available to do it? And finally, for patient advocates, how will this affect your ability to advocate and educate? Whatever your answer is, we'd like to know. So send your answers to questions@surfingmash.com and we'll put them in the podcast. Bye-bye now.
And now for the Season 5, Episode 6 Business Report.
Slava Ukraini, glory to Ukraine, and also Am Yisrael Chai, the people of Israel live. Not a lot to report this week. No new action in Washington, no new action from Israel, no new action from Gaza. But I do have a couple of thoughts. First, I continue to be amazed at the tenacity and talent of Ukrainians. They are conducting highly targeted, very effective drone warfare inside Russia, which I doubt was on anybody's prediction list for this war before it started. Separately, as a Jew who is pro-Zionist but not pro-Bibi, what's happening in Israel right now with their government is one more example of what happens when the head of government is mostly trying to save himself at the expense of what is best for his people. Israel deserves better, particularly the hostages and their families. Choroyim Slava, glory to heroes, and also Am Yisrael Chai, the people of Israel live.
More countries are bringing us back in the top 250 medical list.
Five episodes into our return, we've hit the top 250 medical list in 14 different countries, including Germany, France, UK, Singapore, South Africa, and of course, Romania, which I mentioned last week. If you like what we're doing, keep telling your friends and send us positive reviews as we build our audience back up.
This week, we didn't have to work hard to get our question of the week.
Okay, our question posted slightly before this episode, and also, as you know, in this episode, but after the FDA announcement on Rezdiffra. Please let us know how you are affected by this approval. Your fellow listeners will want to know.
Next up, patient advocates discuss Rezdiffra.
Next week's episode will feature patient advocates discussing what changes in their worlds in the aftermath of the Rezdiffra approval. It should be fun. The advocates are really energized. In subsequent weeks, we will have more people from different stakeholder communities discuss the Rezdiffra approval's impact on them as well.
We're taking a week away from the vault.
Given how long this episode ran and that we're posting conversation Sunday and Monday, we decided to skip the vault until next week. And with that, a very exciting, groundbreaking week in Nashville comes to an end. I want to thank our team, Jorn, Louise, Mike, Eric, Steve. As we march ahead, I want to thank Ian and Laurent and Jeff and Zobair for being available to do this episode on short notice. And again, to congratulate Madrigal for its breadth of vision and dogged attention to getting things right. And to our co-founder and colleague, Stephen, putting the big fat dent he sought in Mazeled. Enjoy our conversation Sunday and Monday. Please take a listen to our question of the week and, of course, reply. We'll be back next week with the patient advocates. Until then, stay safe, surf on. Bye-bye now.
Have any questions for the surfers? You can send them to questions@surfingmash.com and we will answer on the podcast or website. Your question might even wind up being the question of the week.